coming to you live from West Philadelphia. I'm Johannes Stauffer, and with me as always is a couple of guys who are up to no good. And this is the Mildly Alarming Podcast. Episode 71, Parents Just Don't Understand.
Getting jiggy with it.
Hey there, listeners. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Mildly Alarming Podcast. Good to have you here on the show that is to other podcasts what a tugboat is to a canoe. I'm Tom Rich.
I have no idea what that means, and I'm in shock that you got listeners right, and I'm Johannes Stauffer.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Readers, good to have you here.
Idiot.
Oh, it is lovely, though. It is wonderful to have you here aboard with our podcast, listening to it with your ear parts, having a grand old time. Now,
what is a tugboat to a canoe?
Bigger?
Just slightly.
Not slightly. A tugboat is considerably bigger than a canoe.
I don't know. Did you ever see that show? It was like Thomas the Tank Engine, but with boats. He was a little tugboat.
Yeah, but he's still bigger than a canoe.
He was smaller than a canoe.
That's not a very big tugboat.
He was a remote control boat.
Oh, well, fair enough. A tugboat's got to be, has to be minimum large enough to for Jar Jar R. Martin to captain it.
Jarge?
Did I say Jarge?
You said Jar Jar R. Martin, which is some sort of a horrifying cross between Jar Jar Binks and Jar Jar R. Martin.
It's got the little hat and the like crazy ears, and it says, Misa, kill all the characters that you like.
Yep.
Misa write books about knights who say.
To be fair, I don't like most of the characters all that much. So
you haven't even read the books.
Yeah, I have. I've read a couple of them.
Really? I thought you hadn't read them.
No, they're not that great. I don't read them anymore.
Ah, fair enough. He's in modern fantasy. He's pretty much unparalleled for world building, and he's got characterization of people you don't like down pretty solidly.
Yeah,
but he's not a wordsmith like Tolkien was. Like, on a sentence-by-sentence level, I find him somewhat lacking. Sorry, George.
Or like Patrick Rothfuss.
Who's
not... I wouldn't put him on Tolkien level, but he's certainly...
Yeah, I don't remember ever being strongly moved by the lyricism of Patrick Rothfuss one way or the other.
Read it again.
I was never like, I want to poop on you, or I want to lick you a little bit. In either way.
Certainly not.
I'll leave it to you to figure out which of those is good, which is
both
bad.
Both in any order.
Yeah, you don't... You don't want to go... Yeah,
I want to poop on you and then lick it a little bit.
That's not healthy. That's how you get the Giardia.
So welcome to our podcast.
Welcome to our podcast about board games. Good to have you here. Good to have you still here after that nonsense about
tugboats. Yeah, who are we kidding? They all turned it off.
Yeah, they probably... But just sad because they're going to miss some great stuff later on.
It's true.
So now that everybody's out of the room, what do you want to talk about?
I don't care.
Metagaming!
Okay.
That's our topic for tonight, metagaming. Now, meta is a prefix that indicates about, so it's a thing about a thing. So metagaming would be gaming about gaming, would be gaming the game itself. If I talked about, like, for example, metadata in computing, that's data that tells you about data. So it's data about where the input for a given value came from, or who edited it and so on. Data that tells you about the information that is the core of your data experience in this case. If I talk about meta commentary in the academic realm, that's commentary about other commentary. So criticism of other criticism of things that are primary to whatever the topic at hand is. So metagaming is gaming the game surrounding the game. So we have our game itself, and then what happens around that set of rules.
And the root of the prefix meta is actually from a form of ancient German, and it translates to chocolate turkey.
It checks out.
Yeah. I you know, you can follow the etymology down a very long and winding trail to what it means now, but that's definitely where it came from.
It starts out at chocolate turkey because in ancient Germania, the chocolate turkey was held to be not really like sacred or profane, but just fairly surprising. Mm-hmm. And so they felt the need to remark upon it frequently. Like, that is a turkey made of chocolate, and chocolate's not like a thing we import yet, so we're surprised about that part. we're also surprised about the turkey part and the moving around part. Like, there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, yeah.
That I, as a Germanic tribesman of the ancient world, am mildly alarmed by.
So next time you hear, like, a middle schooler exclaim, "That's so meta," just think that what they're really saying is, "That's so chocolate turkey."
Also, meta is a fun word because it anagrams into a lot of other words. You can be like, "Meta team, teammate, eat meat."
So anyway, metagaming.
Yeah, right. So, like, good example of metagaming might be, like, suppose that you were the sort of person who had a regular group of people to play Risk with.
Mm-hmm.
We'll use a game that everybody's familiar with for our example here. And suppose that among your game, the classic Risk strategy of always go for Australia, so always just park your in Australia and just turtle up there and wait for people to come beat their faces against you because it's easy to defend,
mm-hmm.
wasn't something that people tried. Like, nobody does it. And there's nothing, there's no rule against it. It's not like you've house ruled. It's just that nobody in your group thinks to play that move. They don't think, "I will start in Australia and build an iron fortress there."
Mm-hmm.
So the metagame of your Risk group does not contain that strategy at this point, which means if one of you suddenly thinks of it, the metagame shifts, and now everybody has to update their strategies to deal with the fact that the Australia tactic is now part of the game. So that would be the metagame, that kind of unspoken set of assumptions there. If you can assume, or even though a tactic is legal, if you are pretty confident nobody in your group is going to try it or think of it, the metagame kind of selects against it. Similarly, it might be that a given really, really good tactic is dominant in a game, but nobody in your group busts it out, so you don't have to plan around it like you otherwise would in a situation where it was something that people applied.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also add to metagaming things like kind of playing the psychology of another player, because it's external to the game system itself. It's not
right.
Like you're getting points for it, but you're probably going to win as a result. So, like, if you're playing and you're playing with a guy who is a huge jerk and just, like, deliberately tries to get you riled up by poking your buttons and talking while you're trying to think and just being a big dick about it, Mike. No, I'm kidding. I love you, man. That is metagaming you. He's not playing the game against you. He's not playing the rules and the die rolls and the cards. He's playing your psychology. There's a little element of meta to that.
That's a little bit closer to the use of metagaming that I'm more familiar with, which would be particularly in, like, a role-playing game. And I think often in a cooperative role-playing game, metagaming would be saying, "I am going to do things outside of what my character would do in game because I know things as a player who is outside of the game."
Right.
That my character couldn't possibly know.
Yeah.
And there you run into things like min-maxing, which we've talked about before, when mm-hmm. you're rolling up a character, saying, "I'm going to make choices to make sure my character is the most powerful on paper as possible, whether or not that actually makes sense with the character's character." And then there's also an aspect of needing to be a good and potentially experienced role player to be able to take yourself out of that, like, metagame headspace mm-hmm. of, "I know that the DM is likely to do this in our Dungeons and Dragons campaign," or
right.
"I know that I've memorized the monster manual and I know how these monsters function." You don't actually know that. Like, your character doesn't actually know that. And so using that is metagaming. And,
right.
And in the minds of a lot of people, kind of cheating, because your character couldn't possibly know.
Your character, who is a farm boy who happened to stumble into a life of adventure, is not aware of what elements demons are resistant to and how to break it down across different classes of them.
Right.
He doesn't know that. That's not a thing he learned. Well, picking turnips.
Yeah.
You might have.
Which is great for me when I'm playing Dungeons & Dragons, because that's not the sort of information that I bother to look up in the first place. And if I do find it out, it's not the sort of information I tend to retain. So mm-hmm. I can happily just plod my way through a campaign not knowing things about monster types. I mean, I always have to deal with knowing how Tom tends to run a campaign, or knowing how
all of the dungeons
Gary
are
tends
symmetrical?
To do a thing. Yeah, your dungeons are not nearly as symmetrical as the ones that we've been playing in Gary's campaign.
Yeah, that's true. I overcame that once you guys spent, I think, an entire evening mocking me about my symmetrical dungeons.
If it was only one evening, you got off easy.
Well, I mean, one solid evening and then sporadically thereafter.
Sure, okay, yeah. Okay.
Mainly when the dungeon would be asymmetrical and be like, oh, look, it's not symmetrical. I'd be like, I hate you guys. Why do I invite you to my house?
So what are some other aspects of metagaming? And are there times when it's good? I mean, I pretty much exclusively think of metagaming as basically a form of board game cheating.
Yeah, I mean, I guess... Yeah, I guess there's a couple of different... It's obviously lame in a role-playing game when you're right. supposed to be getting into the headspace of the character and getting in there. In a role-playing game... kind of has that different idea, though, of you're all trying to tell a cooperative, the coolest co-op story you can tell. So metagaming isn't, in that case, just giving yourself an advantage so you can win. It's also kind of dragging down everybody's fun in that way, mm-hmm. if that's the kind of thing you're going for. Mm-hmm. If you're just doing like a kick in the door hack and slash thing, it doesn't really matter.
Right.
But if you're trying to get some deep narrative resonance happening, that kind of screws it up. I guess the two kinds I'm a little bit more interested in The one I'm more interested in as a designer is sort of the mechanical metagame,
mm-hmm.
where individual groups sort of develop a set of tactics and ways of playing and ways of thinking that they then know they're doing. And even though they're not written into the game, they still happen and you kind of have to take them into account
mm-hmm.
as you're playing.
Can you give an example? Outside of Risk.
Outside of Risk, yeah. It happens a lot in strategy games where mm-hmm. you know somebody takes particular units and so you have to counter that, whether or not it's the mathematically optimal thing, it's the thing they're going to do.
So you're talking about the metagame of a gaming group being like, I know that Alphonse is the one in Dominion who is likely to buy cards that can curse other players.
Yeah, or if we're playing Arkham, even co-op, if we're playing Arkham, I know that Gary is going to go for a lot of clue tokens,
mm-hmm.
so I know I need to go pursue other goals because he's really going to focus in on that.
Okay, so you're kind of interested in how the group dynamic develops to a point where you wouldn't even have to talk about, you know, should I get clue tokens because you know Gary's going to do it, and so you just, without discussing with the group, assume that's going to happen and go focus on other things?
Yeah, kind of.
Okay.
I don't know that you can really design around it at all, but...
I don't think... I mean, if you're talking about group dynamic metagame, I don't think you can design around it ever, because mm-hmm. unless you're specifically designing a game or a campaign for your group.
Sure.
But if you're talking about game design universal, you know, we're trying to build a game, it's going to be so different depending on the group.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess you can sort of take it into account if you assume that our player types, stereotypes that we talked about in a much earlier episode are accurate and fairly universal, then you could sort of build for that. And we talked about a lot of that with the mm-hmm. the different, you know, the analysis paralysis guy and super yeah. competitive players and whatever. But I don't know that you could make that assumption, because you got to think, especially depending on the type of game you're designing, you may have, like if you look at Pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Pandemic is a game that is pretty straightforward. It's very mechanical. So you can really get pretty strategic about it, but it's also a pretty interesting, fairly involved. There's not really a plot, but like the whole idea of like global diseases mm-hmm. that are wiping out the planet's population. You can get into that as a theme, so you can approach that in a variety of ways with a variety of styles of play, and you can have a brand new gamer get it pretty quickly, and you can have veteran gamers just pouring their time into figuring out the most efficient way to beat this game.
Yeah, to solve the puzzle. I thought of another great example of metagaming from our own group.
Mm-hmm.
We know for a fact with 100% certainty that if there's a boat in a game,
Tom is going to try to get the boat.
I'm going to try to get the boat or be involved with the boat in whatever way the game allows you to interact with the boat. So from the beginning, if you know about that boat, you can plan your strategy and your tasks around the fact that, well, Tom's going straight for the boat as fast as he can.
Tom will be useless as long as a boat is available.
Unless that boat is like the most important thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Which it never is.
The boat's never the most important
thing. And even if the boat is a thing that's like, if you get, you know, near the boat, you become evil and attack all the other players, Tom's still going for the boat. He doesn't care. He just wants the boat.
Torpedoing straight for that boat. So that's metagame, though. Like, that's not part of the game. Nothing forces me to go for the boat, but I'm going for the boat, and everybody at the table knows it.
Mm-hmm. It's true. That's why we...
don't play games with me anymore.
We hate you so much. we've passed up so many boat related games just because we know.
Didn't we actually pass up one of the Arkham expansions for that, among other reasons?
We might have. We certainly ended up with a very boat heavy Arkham expansion, so I don't imagine there's a boatier.
Well, no, the we have Innsmouth Horror, which is water heavy, but there's no real boat.
There's a sea captain and there's a boat.
Yeah, I guess there's a boat. But like the other one, the Kingsmouth Horror expansion that we don't have, that one Kingsport, right. That one lets you become captain of the white ship.
Oh, right. Yes, that is exactly why we didn't get that one. For some reason, I felt like we had the captain of the white ship one already.
No, we don't.
Right.
We decided not to do that because we knew that, well, as we've established.
So should we touch on some other metagame related board game buzzwords like net decking?
Yeah, let's talk about net decking, because I can remember we had a lengthy conversation about net decking, or at least you did, in between swings of your meaty fist into my face when we bought Eclipse. And by we, I mean,
yeah,
because you were like, listen, strategy games are not my bag, really.
Yeah.
But they're fun, but they're not fun when somebody, hint, hint, wink, wink, punch, punch, goes on the internet and looks up all the best strategies and memorizes them and then wins all the time because he looked them up on the internet. So net decking is a term that comes from Mijak the Githerang, that card game that people play because they don't want to have money or a fulfilling life outside of it. Where you, instead of building your deck according to what you want or according to the card collection you have or just thinking your way through it yourself, you go online, find out what the hot deck design is, and there are endless forums for it, and you just build that, and then you have it, and you probably win because there are people out there that just do that. They just make the best deck that they can make with the cards for a given scene or whatever, and then they put it on the internet, and then people play with it, and that, weirdly enough, shapes the metagame for Magic. If we know that the giant green monster deck is an amazingly powerful deck and that a short load of people are going to play it in a given scenario, and a lot of people will because a lot of people net deck, your metagame is now dictated by that.
Yeah.
Even if a card is objectively not that great, if it counters giant green monster or whatever I said before, suddenly it becomes more powerful just because of that metagame, because you know a lot of people will probably be playing it.
Right. And so you get into things like you can net deck anything. It doesn't have to have a deck anymore. That term is sort of universal for the guy who goes and looks online to find out what the best strategy, best combination of character and vehicle in Mario Kart, best multi-class, you know, strategy for your Dungeons and Dragons character, best army and whatever. It doesn't matter.
Right.
Rather than doing, I think a big part of it is rather than doing the work yourself to figure it out, but also just the min-maxy need to have the best,
right?
Whatever it is.
So you think there is a distinction between if I'm playing Eclipse, for example, and I go online and figure out and find a thing that says if your best bet on your interceptors is plasma cannon, missile. Or if I run the math in an Excel sheet myself and figure that out on my own, that has the statistical most damage for a given number of rolls.
I guess I only brought up online because of the net in net deck. I think definitely there's something to having done the work yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're still lame for gaming that way. So I guess there's not a huge distinction, but at least you did the work yourself to ruin everyone else's fun rather than letting someone else do the work for you.
So, I guess what is the distinction? Like what if we take it back a level of abstraction, and instead of running the math and calculating probabilities, I just sit there and think of different ways to build my ships in Eclipse, for example. I just think, well, I can put this many I can get this much power and this many guns and this, and just shuffle the tokens around in my head and ponder it that way and come to a conclusion without actually doing any math. Per se, like calculating probabilities of damage and just figure it out that way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, at what point does it tip over from I'm just thinking about the game to, because I enjoy it, to I am a big lame-o from Lamestan?
Well, I don't know that necessarily it makes you lame. I think it's just, it depends on your approach to gaming.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've discussed several times before, so first of all, it's all still metagaming, right? Because you're still outside of the game thinking about what the best way is to
Yeah, to one degree.
Make the game function. Yeah. I mean, I guess if you were sitting there on someone else's turn in Eclipse, thinking really hard about how to make your ships function the best, then you're just playing the game. Mm-hmm. If you're up night and day thinking about it, even if it's just because you like Eclipse, but you're at that point, you're thinking about it like, how can I make my ships best? How can I make my ships best against the way that Johannes or Alphonse or mm-hmm. Gary tends to play? There's the distinction there. Again, it's not necessarily bad. It depends on your play style.
Uh-huh.
And as we've mentioned before, I don't care for that. I think you could make an argument that the entire game of chess is about net decking. It's about learning the openings and the moves mm-hmm. and whatever. You could say the same thing about Risk. You could say the same thing about a lot of things. And it's just a distinction in how you like to play. If you're going to play very competitively, you need that edge. You need to be able to do those things to compete with the other people who are on that same level with you. And that's fine. That's just not an aspect of games that I find remotely interesting.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like, from what you're saying there, it's almost like the distinction comes in between thinking about it for a particular instance of the game that you're playing right then. So thinking, Johannes has bought these things for his ships, I need to buy these things so that I can be right. competitive with them, versus thinking in theory at a high level across many games, these things will generally be better
right.
on my ships and
right.
against most opponents, maybe not in a specific circumstance, but against many opponents and many rolls of the dice, they'll work pretty good for me.
Mm-hmm.
I dig it.
Yep.
I have a question too. I want another element of metagaming. So suppose that we're playing a board game and I just sit there needling. Well, let's flip it around because it's more likely to go the way. You just sit there needling my psyche, deliberately trying to get me riled up so I can't think clearly about what I'm doing. And you deliberately...
You give me a lot of credit if you think that I do that to affect your gameplay.
Well, okay. Yeah. Fair enough. But
I do that when we're not playing games.
You do. You're doing it literally right now.
Yeah.
You're throwing bricks at me as I talk. But you know what I mean, right?
Yeah.
So you sit there, you deliberately do this. It's not part of the mechanics of the game. It's not like it's a bluffy game or like a game that in the rule book says this is part of what we're up to.
Right.
It's just you're doing it. Or I bought Game of Thrones, the board game, the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And I very deliberately positioned myself next to Gary because I knew I could talk him into an alliance and then betray him. And then I did that. And he was very upset with me. And I'm like... Dude, you knew I was going to do that, right? We're playing Game of Thrones. So, at what point, if any point, is that shitty and awful versus just playing the game, I guess is what I'm saying.
I think, again, it comes down to understanding who you're playing with. I would expect... I don't know that I would expect you to do that to me, actually. I'm always wary of you doing that to me, mm-hmm. but the you were best friends since fourth grade thing kind of like makes it less likely to happen.
Sure.
I would absolutely expect Alphonse to do that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I expect him to do that in real life.
Yeah, one day he's going to stab us both.
Right. That's why I always wear chainmail under my shirts.
Oh, that's a good plan. I should probably, do that. But, it's just got to depend on not just the person you're betraying, but the group and the dynamic. Because,
mm-hmm.
like, that game is designed around stabbing one another in the back. The Game of Thrones game is, right?
Right.
That's kind of the
whole... Yeah, that's a fair point that it depends on the game, too.
Yeah.
Like, the Game of Thrones, it happens.
But, like, we played Eclipse, and I ended up in an alliance with Alphonse. That he betrayed in the last couple turns.
Uh-huh.
And, like, he ended up winning on his own by, like, a couple... Or, no, I don't know if I was even allied with him. I think there's the distinction between an allied victory...
Right.
And then...
Having
diplomatic relations where you're not supposed to... But, yeah, like, I was wary of it, but not wary enough. And so he did it at the last minute. Like, he had some plan that was going to mm-hmm. get him enough victory points that he wasn't going to... really be hurt for the loss of points from betraying a diplomatic relation and ended up winning by a couple points. And like, he's a smug dick anyway. So that's annoying. Like that takes doing that. Being a smug dick about it
mm-hmm.
makes it way worse. So maybe don't do that. Regardless of who you're playing with, no one likes a smug jerk, but, I was a little bothered. I think if he had done it to other people in our gaming group, they would have been a lot more bothered. And mm-hmm. I think if other people in our gaming group had done it to me, I would have been more bothered because I expect murder and betrayal from Alphonse.
Right, just look at his face.
I don't expect it so much from others.
Gary?
Yeah, and so you don't, like, you come back to games are fun. That's what mm-hmm. they're ostensibly for. Mm-hmm. If you are ruining others' fun for the sake of your own victory, maybe examine your life.
That's a fair point, yeah. And if everybody's not on the same page with the game you're playing, maybe mm-hmm. maybe pick a different game.
I would honestly be interested. This is like another part of the reason why I don't like to play Eclipse, is that the game I want out of Eclipse is not the game anyone else in our group wants out of Eclipse. Mm-hmm. And as we mentioned before, allowing me my like peaceful, happy exploration and upgrade without ever attacking anyone in mm-hmm. Eclipse virtually guarantees my victory while everyone else is destroying one another.
Scrambling over the charred remnants of one another's empires, yeah.
But I would honestly at least once be interested to see no one ever attacked anything other than a third...
A neutral.
Like a neutral yeah. alien game in that, just to see how it would turn out. I find that more interesting than the game with player-on-player combat as it currently exists.
We should design a purely pacifist space sim.
We could do that. We do it with intergalactic politics.
I remember that game. That was fun.
Yeah.
We used to play Legos back in the day, and we're like 7 or 8, like prime testosterone-y young man. We want to play violent games time in our lives. We played intergalactic politics with our
Legos. Is testosterone a pasta or a sandwich meat?
I hope. I think it's probably a sandwich meat. Like, it suggests pastrami to me.
Yeah.
Only a little bit more, you know, to it.
But yeah, intergalactic politics. Tom had the most incredible collection of Lego spaceships.
Because
it was, what was there? Was they all ended in Tron until the UFOs ones came out.
Yeah, I can't remember all their
names.
There's
like Space Tron and Magnetron were the red ones.
There was Black Tron.
That's
yeah,
right.
There were a lot of them. Yeah.
And then there's the UFO ones. I remember those were new when we were in what, like fourth or
they
fifth
were they
grade.
Were coming out right as we were getting to the tail end of Lego years
yeah.
in our life,
and that was when they first started adding like Magnetron, and those were cool because they had like parts that swiveled and moved,
yeah,
and then like
and
they had
magnets.
That
yeah.
was the big thing about Magnetron, so they could pull apart without like pulling actual Lego blocks apart. UFO was like the first like fiber optics, flashy lights, batteries,
also,
moving parts.
You may be hearing explosions in the background. It is the 2nd of July
yeah.
in America right now.
And I live in a sort of hillbilly neighborhood. They've been setting off fireworks since for the last 2 months, really.
Yeah. So that we are celebrating the birth of our nation with explosives in the sky. So that's what you're hearing in the background.
Yes.
There. We'll be talking about that in the second half of the show.
Yep.
Yeah, but we played intergalactic politics. We would have, there was like a galactic council, and we would have the ships fly around, and they would carry ambassadors to one of them. Sometimes they would fight, because politics,
yeah,
war is politics, continued by other means.
It was a lot like, we talked a little bit the other day, I think it was you and I, about, you and me, about just how weird the entire concept of mutually assured destruction and
yeah,
like the Cold
yeah.
War was. And like, I had this thought while I was mowing the lawn the other day, something huge flew over my house, but it was in the clouds, so I could just hear it. And I was like thinking about, you know, being old enough to be cognizant of that, like in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
being like, there were nations that were just like, yeah, we'll nuke the crap out of you. And other nations who were like, if you do that, even though we're guaranteed to die, we're going to nuke the crap out of you just so that you also suffer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's freaky. That's childish yeah. nonsense.
Well,
it never got to that point. So the whole Cold War
right.
was this like diplomatic tension.
Uh-huh.
That's what intergalactic politics
yeah.
was. It was like the point of the game was almost like, don't allow that to happen. You have lost.
We should. That's a good game. We should.
Yeah.
Make
well,
that
we've
game.
We've kind of danced around it a lot. Never really got.
We've never come down to a mechanic.
Yeah.
That fits for it.
It's worth working on, though.
It's worth working.
That would really be pretty much require metagaming. That would be a game that's like, if you don't know outside of the game how a given player reacts in this type of situation, you're pretty much just like, well, mm-hmm. cross my fingers and hope they don't nuke me.
That kind of fits too with a concept I've seen online a couple times of like a mega game.
Uh-huh.
Where they'll have like 30 people playing at once, and they're like, it's like almost like a Model UN type thing where
uh-huh.
you'll have people take on different roles within a given country, and then you'll have to send your ambassador, and only they can cross the room to talk to the mods and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And they're these huge events, and they're crazy. But it's a similar idea.
I think we should do something like that, or someone should do something like that, but take it, make it even bigger. So I'm just thinking, there was a game we played called... Oh, I forget what it's called now. Microsoft made it, and then it got a huge cult following, and they dropped support.
Are you thinking of Allegiance?
Yes, it's like the only thing that Microsoft has ever allowed to become open source.
Mm-hmm. Allegiance was it was a space simulator.
But a huge one, because like, it's a real-time strategy game, and there are like commanders in these high command positions commanding huge groups and armies and whatever, but then not armies, but fleets, because it's in space. Mm-hmm. The fleets that they're commanding are piloted by actual other players, and so you can be like a pilot of a ship, of a big ship that's got like gunners and stuff on it, or a single pilot little fighter craft, or even a probe, or you can be the commander who's telling all of them what to do. Mm-hmm. Against another commander telling another 30 to 100 people in little ships what to do. It's pretty insane.
It's pretty sweet.
So I'm thinking, take that, like, Model UN intergalactic politics mega game.
Mm-hmm.
Have, you know, your delegates and whatever, but also have fleets in, like, a Artemis-style, like, crewed ships. Like, you could take over an entire office building.
Yeah.
Have each room be, like, a ship. Have the conference... Oh, it would be so cool. It'll never happen.
See, all of the mega games I've read about are done in the UK. I don't know how many happen in the Americas.
Yeah.
So, like, if we scripted rules for a mega game, like, the Ann Arbor area has a pretty... We live near Ann Arbor. I've just given away our hometown.
Again?
Oh, have we already talked about that?
Yeah. Last week, you gave me crap about giving away that we live near Ann Arbor after we had talked at length about how close we live to Chelsea, Michigan, where we're going to Protospiel.
Fair enough. My address is... no, but, like, it's got a fair number of game people around here. We could probably arrange it.
Yeah.
It'd be fun. I don't want to do that much work. I want to take mat naps.
Mat naps?
Mat naps.
I don't know what those are.
I don't know what that... I'm uncomfortable with what I said. Let's move on.
All right. You have anything else to bring up about metagaming?
No, I mean, it's part of it. It's something to be aware of, I guess. I guess the only part of it I would say don't do is don't be a dick to your fellow players to win. Like, don't deliberately try to render your opponent so speechlessly furious that they cannot focus on the game, because now you're ruining everybody's fun.
Yeah,
for no reason. That's a jerk move.
Yep.
And you know, maybe make sure if you're playing a game that's going to be emotionally draining, like Game of Thrones or Eclipse, where there's going to be a little bit of the old ribby.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe make sure everybody's up for that before you play.
Yep.
And make sure too, when you do those, that you set that expectation beforehand. You're like, this is what we're doing. Nobody get all butt hurt. That's what we're up to. That's what the game is.
Yep.
And then afterward, make sure you've got snacks. Like, you know, some snacks for everybody. Because snacks
make everyone happy.
They make it better.
Except for Alphonse, because he can't eat any of them.
It's true. He's the one that's allergic to everything. We did an episode about that earlier. Check the archives.
Yeah, I guess that's what we got about metagaming.
Metagaming.
And Alphonse's
and the fact
allergies.
That Alphonse might die.
Yep.
Did we admit it was Alphonse last time?
Yeah. Like, well, okay. No, not in the episode, but it's been brought up since then.
Okay, good.
He gave us the go-ahead.
Oh, good. I hate to bring up people's allergies that they might die of when they didn't give me permission to do that.
I don't. I love it. Anyway, we'll be right back after this.
Is this the commercial? Or
I guess we should tell them where to find us.
Oh,
they're listening to us already, but...
we should tell them how to contact us.
Sure.
It's the contact thing that's next.
Sure, yeah. So, if you think this segment is terrible...
Are we breaking for... A commercial now, or are we breaking for Mildly Alarming Theater?
Mildly Alarming Theater is up next.
Okay, Mildly Alarming... Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
This is riveting stuff to listen to.
It's amazing.
So anyway, if you want to contact us and tell us how bad our podcast has gotten, given that it didn't even start all that great, it has to have sunk pretty low, you can hit us up on Twitter at Mildly Alarming.
You can send us emails at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
You can leave a comment on the website at www.mildlyalarming.com.
Or you can shout... Your comment as you lift weights and as you grunt with each extension of your arms, we will hear those. If you do it right. And we're in the same gym as you.
Pretty close, like probably in the free weights area.
Yeah, we're going to have to be right. We're going to really need to be spotting you as you do that if you want us to understand what you're talking about.
We got these headphones on. It's really hard to hear anything that doesn't come through the microphone.
Yeah, really, we're going to need to set up all of our equipment first before that.
So anyway... I guess enjoy this new installment of Mildly Alarming Theater.
It's pretty good.
Recently, we read an article that included the sentence, "For many centuries, people created technologies that made the horse more productive and more valuable, like plows for agriculture and swords for battle." The following is our take on what the invention of the sword may have been like in this scenario.
"Rise, my subject! They tell me you are a smith of great renown, and have brought me an invention that will bring woe to my enemies. Come, show me what you have done."
"Behold, my king, I have invented the sword."
"See how it gleams in the light of the torches. Such craftsmanship. Tell me of the sword, O blacksmith."
"The blade is like that of a knife, but much longer, as you can see. There's a piece that goes across the middle here, and a handle down here so that you can hold on to it. I wrapped that bit in leather."
"Magnificent! Your hands will run with gold, and your sons will drink the finest wines. Show me how the sword is wielded, most noble of blacksmiths."
"Verily I shall, my king. Accompany me to the stables, and I will demonstrate the worth of the sword."
"There is no need to slay the ox or the fatted calf as a demonstration, blacksmith. Just demonstrate on the air. Swing it around a little."
"Your pardon, my king, but I would need an horse to demonstrate."
"A horse? But it costs me a bag of gold for one of my royal chargers. I need them to pull my chariot. What virtue has the sword that a horse must die merely to show its prowess?"
"Oh, the horse won't die. The sword goes on the horse."
"Come again?"
"Well, you kind of tie it to the horse's head with, well, twine, I suppose."
"Why would you do that?"
"Well, that's what it's for, my lord. To make the horse more productive and valuable in battle."
"The sword is."
"Right you are, my king."
"The sword goes on the horse."
"Aye."
"You're sure?"
"Well, I did invent it, didn't I?"
"It's just..."
"Yes?"
"Well, it's just that the handle and the bit that goes across the middle, it just looks to me like a person could hold it and swing it about and hit people with it."
"Yes?"
"Well, maybe he could do it better than a horse could if you strap the sword to the side of its head."
"Oh, so you're the expert on swords now, eh?"
"Now, don't be that way."
"See, a very first sword, and the very first sword there's ever been, and suddenly you're an expert on how it works."
"Now, that's not what..."
"Never mind, the old thing was my idea. I've spent months figuring out how to make the bit that goes across the middle, and I've been sneaking into every stable in the kingdom and tying this to horses' heads just to see how it works, make sure I had the weight right. But no, forget all that. You're right. A person should hold the sword in his hand and bop people on the head with it. Pfft."
"Just wait a moment."
"Typical management type. Think you know everything."
"Well, it's got a handle, though, doesn't it? And you don't usually strap a handle to things. Axes have handles, and you don't tie them to anything. You hold them in your hand."
"But you're not an horse. Horses don't have hands. They got hoofs."
"I don't think you tie axes to horses, either."
"You might, if you wanted a horse to have an axe. Can't hold an axe with your hoofs."
"I think it's hooves."
"Oh, so now you're an expert on the proper plural form of an equid's forelimbs, are you?"
"Actually, yes. I studied grammar. But we're not talking about plurals, we're talking about swords. I'm sorry to harp on it, but it seems like the handle suggests holding. Maybe the horse could hold the sword in its mouth."
"How would you get it to do that?"
"What? Hold it in its mouth? Just stick it in there."
"Stick it in there? An horse won't hold something just because you jam it in its mouth."
"They hold bits in their mouths."
"Well, that's fixed to the bridle, and that's all tied around the horse's head. Can't very well spit it out when it's strapped to his head."
"I suppose you could strap the sword to the horse in the same way."
"But now we're back to strapping it. So why look a sword horse in the mouth and just strap it to its head instead?"
"But will a horse really strike someone with a sword strapped to its head?
How would a horse know to do that? I'm having a hard time picturing what this looks like.
Well, turn it around. How would one of your soldiers know to bonk a fella on the head with the sword if he was holding it in his hand?
Well, I suppose he'd think that the sword was like a very sharp club, and he'd puzzle it out by analogy.
Right. Same with an horse.
Same with a horse? You're telling me that a horse, an animal, that will walk past the same tree every day for a year and then panic if the wind makes the leaves move around a bit more than usual, you're saying that such an animal will derive, by analogy, how to attack someone with a sword strapped to its head?
Might.
What's it even making an analogy to? What else do we strap to horses' heads that they then attack people with?
Well, look who knows everything about horses now, in addition to grammar and the brand new, never-before-seen invention of the sword.
Now, don't be upset. I'm just trying to understand here.
Well, it's a bit rude, is all.
Wait, just a moment. Now, stop that. Stop that. You're right. I shouldn't have stepped in on your area of expertise. That was wrong of me, and I apologize. Master of Arms! Commission me 10,000 swords, and strap them to the heads of 10,000 horses. We shall crush our enemies.
And so the king of the Spabuya Dilidandrian Empire rode out against his enemies, and was immediately and completely defeated, for a variety of reasons, not the least of which was that it's very hard to tie a sword to a horse's head without the blade cutting the twine and falling off. But his army of horses with swords strapped to their heads gave rise to the stories of unicorns, which persist to this very day.
No, it didn't. That's dumb.
Quite.
Mildly Alarming Podcast. We're back, everybody. Welcome.com.
Tom thought he was singing just then.
Was that not rap?
Fantastic. And I'm Johannes Stauffer.
Good to have you guys back on the Mild Iron Podcast. Thank you for sticking with us. We do appreciate your listenership. And
you got it right again.
It's good to have you, though. It's good to be here. Good to be doing the thing in the place.
Well, Rick, we're recording here a couple days before Independence Day, the 4th of July. So we're going to be talking about fireworks. But before we do that, there's a story we keep planning to tell on the podcast and then not doing. There's actually a few times where you'll hear one of us begin to tell it, or like Tom will say, "Do you want me to tell that story?" And they'll be like, "We'll get to it in a minute." And then we never get to it.
We don't get to
we
it.
We had a whole segment last week that we not entirely, but largely brought up just so we could finally get to the story, and then we forgot to get to the story.
See, the problem is we often bump the story to the second half of the show, which we record after finishing the gin and tonics.
Yeah.
So, you know how it is.
So now we're finally going to do it. This is a story.
Right, so let's talk about fireworks.
So we really like fireworks.
They're great, yeah. No, okay, the story. So the story is called A Hoax of Amazing Audacity. And really, the best way to tell it is to start with the fact that I occasionally am trusted to teach college-level writing classes. And just think about that for a minute. Just think about that with your brain parts. Isn't that terrifying?
I can hear hundreds of people just weeping.
Yeah.
However many days in the future from when this is actually released.
So occasionally I am entrusted to teach these classes. And one time, when I was just starting out, when I was a teaching assistant at college, doing that
at college,
I was standing up in front of my class and I was going to give them a lecture about why they shouldn't use Wikipedia as a source in an academic paper, and then I was going to go from there and talk about proper citations and good evaluations of sources and all of that. And so I was going to do, as a joke to show them why they shouldn't use Wikipedia, I was going to log into the article on bats and click edit, and I was just going to vandalize it a little bit and then not save it. I'd just be like, and here's why you shouldn't use it, because I can just go in here and I can say that bats kill 30,000 American children annually. I can do that.
It's really only 29,000.
Yeah, it's not that high. Only what happened in front of a room of 25 to 30 freshmen who trusted me to teach them things.
Well, they didn't really have a whole lot of choice.
Yeah, they did. There were other people teaching that class. They, was that I clicked edit on the Wikipedia page. And a little box popped up that said, "You have been banned from editing Wikipedia for vandalism." And I kind of scratched my head as they all looked at me and looked at the error message up on the board there. And I'm like, I really should have practiced this lesson before I got up in front and started doing it. And I go, and this is why you don't, you know, use Wikipedia, because guys like me vandalize it sometimes. Sometimes I vandalized Wikipedia in the not-so-distant past, and that's why I'm banned. Because I went in and I just put in bad information on the Wikipedia, and it was there. And you could have cited it in your papers, and you would have been wrong to do so. And then we had a good laugh, and another one of them dropped my class, probably.
That's not really the story, though.
That's not the story. The story comes from there, and it's what got me banned in the first place. Well, among other things, the thing that got me banned was the time that I went on Wikipedia one summer's day when I didn't have anything better to do, and I started creating a fake comic book called Captain Willie Peters Madhouse, and it was about Captain William Richard Peters, who was on a quest through the Wallet Lands to find and rescue his wife Bianca, Queen of the Cat People. And it had a cast of goofy characters, and it was written by people named Arlo Destin and Merton Banks. And it had a couple of hundred issues, and there were all sorts of stuff, and there were like these arcs and sagas, all the things you expect out of comic books, you know, goofy stuff like that. And so I was making Wikipedia pages about all of this stuff, about the characters.
And Chutney McDermott and Chutney the Bacon McDermott Brigade.
And the Bacon Brigade, Charpedo Jones and the Mandible Patrol. Yeah. You know, all kinds of people. And so I was making Wikipedia pages about all this stuff, you know, like you would expect, like pages about, you have pages about Superman, and you have pages about the Avengers, and you have pages about Marvel Civil War and all of these different parts of comic books. And so I was just goofing around making these fictional ones and linking them to each other, but not to the wider world, because they were not real. There was nothing for them to link to. And so eventually, after a couple of hours of this, a Wikipedia mod comes in and flags all of my stuff for deletion because, well, he writes something like, yeah, all of this stuff only links to itself and doesn't have any outside sources.
What was it? How many pages of Google search results?
None, I think.
No, but he said how for many pages of Google search and no links to this article.
I don't remember now. But not many. Not the amount he would expect.
I think what he said was like, I think he said something like 8 pages of Google search results and no links to this article.
Oh, right.
Like, he just searched, you know, Captain Willie Peters or whatever, yeah, and just dug through pages.
And so then I shot him back a message. I said, no, it's just obscure. It's kind of an indie thing. I'm
like taking your pretty much harmless production of fiction and taking it a step further and outright lying to a real human being.
Yep. And so, no, it's just obscure. It's kind of an indie thing. I'm working on getting sources for all of this stuff. And he bought it. And so that lasted for about 24 hours before he permanently deleted all of it and banned me with the message, banned, something along the lines of, banned for creating an amazing quantity of hoax material of amazing audacity. Some of it's pretty funny. And that's how I got banned from Wikipedia.
I think he also said something about, you clearly have a lot of creative ability. Maybe it would be better used elsewhere.
I think it was like, you could clearly be a better contributor to Wikipedia.
Yeah.
If you, you know, didn't just make stuff up and put it in there. Sadly, I didn't learn my lesson as I made a Wikipedia article for the guy across the hall from me my sophomore year. Just to tweak him a little bit because he only had one ball. And that was the thing I put about him in the Wiki article.
Yeah,
it's like, this guy only has one ball. And then it was a Wikipedia page for about 20 minutes.
There was also a time when we were watching TV. I don't remember what we were watching at my parents' house. We're all sitting around with laptops, as we did at the time. And one of those Happy Kwanzaa commercials came on. And I think my dad goes, "What is Kwanzaa? Like, what is it a celebration of?" And Tom just goes, "Nobody really knows what Kwanzaa is."
And so then, In between the time I said that and Johannes frantically looked up Kwanzaa on Wikipedia, I managed to get in, delete the entire Kwanzaa Wikipedia page, and put up "Nobody really knows what Kwanzaa is" as the Wikipedia entry, and it was there just...
for like a split second.
Just long enough for Johannes to find it.
So when I pulled up the Wikipedia page for Kwanzaa, it literally just said, "Nobody really knows what Kwanzaa is."
And then the auto pruner rolled it back, because when you delete, you know, several thousand words of an article and replace them with like eight, it guesses that something is up.
And fixes it. Yeah. But this is one of the reasons that Wikipedia is one of the greatest sources of entertainment on the entire
internet.
Oh,
it's fantastic.
So with that, let's get into fireworks.
Oh yeah, fireworks. So as some of you may have puzzled out from earlier in the show, we like the 4th of July a lot. Yeah. Now, many of you, according to our statistics, are not from the United States of America. You're from places like Britain, or Germany, or South Africa, or India, perhaps, among other places.
Japan.
We have some Japan people listening.
Japan people.
Yeah, I don't think that's the right way to say that. But people in Japan, they're not necessarily Japanese.
Right,
they could
be
expats from other places.
They were Pats before.
They used to be Pats, but now they're not.
Changed their name to something else.
Right, sort of like how our friend Pat changed his name from Pat.
What is it? Oh, that's
it,
right.
Used to be also Pat.
Yeah.
But he changed it to Pat. He just wanted that on his record. But anyway, we like the 4th of July is, as if you don't know, and you probably do because we're good at exporting our culture in the United States, it's a celebration of the day that America signed the Declaration of Independence. Kinda. They didn't.
It's a celebration of the day that America signed the Declaration of Independence observed.
Yeah. Yeah. We kind of just picked that day. Yeah. It was signed a little bit. Some of it was signed before, some was signed after. It took a while back in the day for everybody to get to Philly to put their John Hancock on that bad lad.
Well, just one guy put the John Hancock on that bad lad.
Yeah, what was his name?
I think it was George Wendt.
George Wendt, right. But that's what we're celebrating. We're all excited about it. The day we gave the British the middle finger, which we have continued to do ever since, despite the fact that we love them and we're like bros. The only bigger bro we have is Canada. Right?
Just because they're physically larger.
Well, they're physically larger, and they're, like, right there.
It's true. We're touching all the time.
Yeah, they're 20 minutes from here. More than that? 40? Maybe? Yeah,
depends on what part of Canada and how you're getting there, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. You could probably get to Canada in 40 minutes, I would say, from here, maybe?
Yeah, I think so.
If you hauled.
Driving.
Yeah, if you hauled.
What we're talking about. You could fly there faster.
Not really. You'd have to get all the way to Detroit and then get on a plane and then fly. That'd take way more than 40 minutes.
Not if you have a plane.
I don't have a plane, though.
What's wrong with you?
Well, I'm...
Everyone has a plane, Tom.
I don't have a plane!
It's because you're a loser.
We like the 4th of July a lot here, though. It is our favorite holiday, and I don't know about Johannes, but here's why it's my favorite holiday. Of all of them. Blows Christmas out of the water, beats the crap out of Thanksgiving, beats up Halloween, and takes its lunch money and its candy. And here's why. On Halloween, you have to wear a stupid costume and go to a party. It's terrible. On Thanksgiving, you have to drive somewhere and eat a bunch of turkey. There's a big fat obligation there. Like, if you don't do something for Thanksgiving, if you don't do that particular thing for Thanksgiving, it's kind of sad, really. Like, people are like, why are you
by yourself drinking straight out of a bottle of scotch?
Yeah. It's like, are you okay for Thanksgiving? Or like, if you don't go home for Thanksgiving and you're away at college, like, that's real sad. Like, that's a sad dorm to be in. Christmas? Thanksgiving on steroids. Not only do you have to go somewhere for a giant family get-together, and I like family. I don't mind them. I hate get-togethers. Terrible. You also have to buy a bunch of presents, and you have to get a bunch of presents, and everything about gift-giving and gift-receiving makes me uncomfortable anymore. It's just like, I feel bad about this. Even though the thing you got me is objectively great, and I like it, and I appreciate it, I am screaming in soul agony right now.
Or sagony.
It might not be a problem with the holidays. It might be me.
It's probably you.
It's probably
I adore Christmas.
But the fourth of July, there's nothing.
If just you, meat and explosives.
There's not even really that. Like, if you just want to chill at home, nobody cares.
That's true.
Nobody cares what you do on the 4th of July. You get the day off, or maybe the day before if it falls on a weekend, and you're lucky that way. You get the time off, and it's just like, maybe go watch some fireworks. Maybe grill some meat. Maybe have some buddies over. Maybe have a beer. Maybe go to bed. Whatever you want to do, man. It's the 4th of freaking July. It is the best possible holiday. It's amazing. I love it so much.
So what we choose to do with our 4th of July, since high school, when we discovered that we're now old enough to buy explosives.
That was a beautiful day when we realized that.
Is just blow a lot of stuff up. Just a lot of stuff.
So now, when we were in high school, we live in Michigan, and we were also in Michigan at that point. Most fireworks were illegal in Michigan.
I believe the rule of thumb was if it leaves the ground, it's illegal.
You cannot have that. So we would have to drive down to the Ohio border. If you crossed into Ohio, you could buy fireworks, and there were a few counties right on the border in Michigan that were like grandfathered in or something.
They are counties that are both in Ohio and in Michigan, so they are grandfathered in somehow to the
It was a weird law.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
So they were allowed to sell fireworks. We would drive down there, about 45 minutes maybe.
Yeah.
Roughly. We would buy a bunch of fireworks. We'd collect money from our friends for the show. And then we would come back and we would just launch them. We would just spend an evening firing them off either in my front yard or Johannes' parents' yard or wherever, you know? We would just fire them. And then we would grill up some food. We would drink some root beer.
Yep.
We'd just have a lovely time.
We should get some root beer for tomorrow.
We should. Spreckers? IBC? Whatever. Yes.
Both?
Henry Weinhard?
Mix it all together? Actually, that might be awesome.
That might be. I don't know. Have you ever had root beer schnapps?
No.
It's not great, but it'll get you drunk.
That's ringing endorsement.
But that's what we do on the 4th. It's great. It's just a low-key, low-stress, low-expectation holiday. And you can just have fun with it, and it's great. But you should be careful with fireworks. You should be very careful because they can kill you. Or they can burn you, or they can take off chunks of your hand. So you should be very careful when you set them off. And you should, if you buy the mortars, which is a cardboard tube that you slide a shell down into, and the wick sticks up and then out of the tube, and then you light it and it goes down and then it explodes and it shoots up out and blows up in the sky.
Hopefully.
If you buy those and then you set off a bunch of them from the same tube,
tube starts to kind of get some wear and tear.
It gets a little wear and tear. It gets a little soot build up on the inside. You should scrape that. You should scrape it, because if you don't, hypothetically, a shot could get stuck.
And blow up at ground level.
And blow up at ground level, hypothetically. And it's incredibly loud and so cool.
And if you're doing what we do, you're also setting off two or three other mortars at the same time. So it could conceivably knock over those mortar tubes before they shoot into the air. And then when they successfully shoot out of their mortar tubes, they might shoot directly at you or into a crowd of your friends and family. We don't condone that.
That never actually happened, right?
No.
Okay.
Not yet. So we've gotten way into, well, I won't say way into, but we really like the fireworks.
Every year we talk about getting pyrotechnic licenses.
Yeah, it escalates each year. I actually started doing some research on those, like, electronic controls and the charges and everything so that we could actually, like, have some timing to our shows. Right now what we do is we set up three or four mortar tubes and have three or four of us walk out there and, like, light the wicks.
At the same
time.
And
then run, and hopefully we get them all at once, which that's part of the fun of it.
It's part of the fun, but like really picture it. Just take a moment. Are you closing your eyes? Close them if they're still open. And just make a picture with your mind. It's muggy. There's not a lot of skeeters, but there's a few out. You got to slap them away now and again. It's dusk. You got that nice purpley black sky. It's slashed by pine and other sorts of trees, so you don't have a perfect view of the horizon, but you've got a nice wide view enough that you can safely fire off your fireworks. You have a charred and blackened hunk of wood in the middle of a flat space of land, and there's sand around it. And you've got up on a hill nearby, you've got your friends and family sitting in plastic lawn chairs. They got hot dogs, they got beer, they got root beer. They're having a nice time, they're watching. And you go out, and you set up your mortar, and you put it in there, and you flick your lighter, and you hear that click, 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 and then it goes. Finally, it catches, the butane catches, and it's burning, and you've got that, and you put it down, and you hear that wick as it catches, and it starts to burn, and you turn, and you jog away. You don't have to go too fast. You just got to get a light jog away, but you got a little sweat going because it's muggy, and it's sweaty, and your shirt is clinging to you a little bit, and you turn, and you look, and you hear it pop, and you see that spark trail go up into the sky, and then right up above you, it bursts. And green and gold and red and blue and all kind of colors. And you do it again for a couple of hours there. It's America.
It's a lot of fun for us. And if you're our family and friends watching, apparently the fun is not so much the fireworks, but watching a couple Gumpy dudes running away from explosives every time they finally get them lit.
Yeah, so,
or sometimes when one of us gets one lit and the other one doesn't, we're like, go, 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 go!
Run away! Yeah, it's good times.
So that's our experience of the 4th of July. If you have a different or arguably better one, you should let us know.
Or if you are not a 4th of July type person and your nation has another similar sort of holiday that you love, let us know about that too.
Oh, if you do Guy Fawkes Day, I want to hear about that. I've been to a couple. I've got some British friends who live in the area who've had some monster Guy Fawkes Day bonfires and done some fireworks, but that would be one that seems in celebration style pretty close to our 4th of July. I'd like to hear about that.
That'd be good.
So hit us up on Twitter at @mildlyalarming.
Shoot us yonder email at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
Leave us a comment on mildlyalarming.com.
Or carefully set up a pyrotechnics display to fire your message into the sky and we'll see it.
You can also find us on iTunes, where you can leave us a review. You can find us on Stitcher. There's an RSS feed on our website. And if you already have a podcast app on your phone or other device, you can probably just search for the Mildly Alarming Podcast, and you'll find us there. So we will see you next week.
Boom.
Toodles.
Happy 4th, everyone. The Mildly Alarming Podcast is brought to you by Soft Quatch Bigfoot Shampoo. Your Bigfoot's hair is all tangled and full of burrs and little bits of documentary filmmaker. The special Sasquatch in every girl's life eventually smells like the underside of a grizzly's fat roll's taste. Spruce up your quatch with Soft Quatch Bigfoot Shampoo. Let your quatch luxuriate in a warm spray and work the thick suds of Soft Quatch into his fur. Feel the coarse, riny hair between your fingers as you massage the oils and lotions of Soft Quatch into every nook and cranny of your quatch's pelt. Lather until he looks like a big, puffy marshmallow, then hose him down and repeat until his hair is soft, lustrous, and cozy to the touch. Now you can curl up on your quatch's belly, safe and secure in his clean, warm fur. And for quatch hair that's shinier and softer yet, follow up with Soft Quatch Bigfoot Conditioner and Soft Quatch Bigfoot Hair Make Shiny Lotion. The Soft Quatch family of quatch cleaning products are specially built to make your Sasquatch the best quatch it can be. And if your quatch isn't 100% satisfied, we'll give you a 100% refund. Soft Quatch. Treat your quatch right.